Caribou Community Radio is proud to broadcast the 31st Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place from July 4th through 7th at Waterfront Park in Portland. Caribou will be broadcasting the festival from noon to about 10 p.m. every day, and will be broadcasting throughout the state on Oregon Community Media radio stations from Ashland and Astoria to Warm Springs. Again, that's the 31st annual broadcast of the Waterfront Blues Festival, taking place July 4th through 7th, noon to 10 p.m. or so, every night at Waterfront Park in Portland and on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 10 o'clock, time for the Lit Fantastic.
Welcome to the Lit Fantastic, a show about authors and their obsessions. I'm your host, Neil Aiken, and today we're speaking with the poet Hari Aluri. Hari is the author of The Flayed City, Carving Ashes, and the chapbook The Promise of Rust. His poetic, curational, and translation work appears in anthologies, journals, and online venues, and recently through The Margins, Pomelian, and Poetry International. A co-founding editor of Locked Horn Press and recipient of several grants and awards, he immigrated to Vancouver, Coast Salish territories at age 12, where he again works and writes. In this conversation, Hari and I discuss his obsession with mudras, a type of symbolic or ritual hand gesture in Hinduism and Buddhism, and also his fascination and long-term fandom of martial arts.
I was going down this rabbit hole around these sort of mudras, which are like ancient South Asian hand language. You find them in both dance and martial arts, like an ancient dance musical mythic theater that leans on them very heavily as part of its language, as well as a friend of mine I was talking to, who, as I am, is kind of a geek for like kung fu and ninja movies, and he was like, "Oh, don't you remember that?" The mudras are all up in ninjutsu, and I was like, that's right, they are. So that's the direction I was going in. At the same time, when you say strangest, I'm thinking about those and all these other forms of esoteric knowledge and practice that are kind of seeping into my life these days, and seem to be showing up everywhere I go. But when you say most unexpected, I think amongst poets anyway, and amongst poets that I've hung out with, my most unexpected obsession would have to be watching and sometimes practicing in the past martial arts, specifically mixed martial arts, the most violent slash popular rendition of which is the UFC. And I've told people before that given the option, I have a tough choice between going to a poetry reading and watching people fight on a screen or in front of.
Well, so they really are tied together, aren't they?
They are, strangely, I suppose. There's a martial arts rendition to both of them, both of which kind of like intersect in multiple parts of my childhood. Notably, you know, on a couch surrounded by friends pretending we knew how to do the martial arts we were watching.
What I find, you talk about this as a form of esoteric, you know, obscure, even sacred knowledge. And I find, you know, because when you originally, you know, had suggested that you might talk about the mudras, I read up a little bit and I thought, oh, this is probably going to wind up talking about martial arts and ninjutsu and then like, lo and behold, here we are talking about ninjutsu and martial arts. And I was thinking about, one of the things that I find fascinating in Chinese, the tradition of Chinese, martial arts, the tradition of Chinese calligraphy, and the tradition of Chinese poetry is all intertwined. that when you would test in ancient times, when you would take the exams, the civil exams for a government position, you were, or a military position, you were tested on all of those, that your calligraphy, your ability to write poetry, and your military prowess as sort of an ability to fight were all in effect being measured. And in fact, some ways they evaluated your ability to fight based on your poetry and your calligraphy.
That blows my mind, partially because it's, for a long time I have, you know, on and on again, off again, obsessed with an attempt to like articulate a poetics through martial arts. I've done some Filipino martial arts along the way, practicing in Vancouver, Kali specifically in Vancouver, and then when I was in Toronto, I did a specific form of escrima called cincoteros, which was like the goro. So as opposed to guru, G-U-R-U in the transliteration, it's either G-U-R-O or G-O-R-O, more of a master of the physical. The guro in Toronto was from the same part of the Philippines as my grandfather, as my lolo, and so I had this kind of like, you know, I was writing fiction in my head while I practiced, thinking about them hanging out as kids and kind of like getting into street fights together. But I also do want to say out loud and admit that if I tested for any of those, I can almost guarantee that I would fail in the calligraphy section. I've never been able to write anything other than chicken scratch. I've been accused of, you know, regularly they're like, oh, do you want to be a doctor? Because you can't write on a page. And I was like, that's the closest thing I have to becoming a doctor is a lack of handwriting. It's like the one skill I have that will allow me to go in that direction is having an illegible hand.
It makes me think back to when I was in seventh grade, maybe sixth or seventh grade. I was both doing well in class, near the top of the class, and yet I was also in a remedial handwriting class because my handwriting was so terrible.
That would be me. That would be me for sure.
I can't say that it helped. I think I momentarily improved enough to get through. And then even now, my, you know, there are days when my long hand looks much better than, you know, it did. And then sometimes it looks pretty awful, where I'm the only one that could probably read it. People also can't read my signature. They can't tell if I'm writing in Chinese or in English.
Nice. It's a good signature, though. That's what you kind of, you want a signature that's almost invincible in terms of its ability to resist being copied.
Yeah, and I think that partly came because I used to paint, and so the signature evolved from when I would sign with a brush, and so I had big bold strokes, and then that carried over to when I signed in pen or pencil.
So you might actually do well in the calligraphy part.
Only with my own name. Yeah. Only with my own name, which feels like that should be a book.
That's not bad.
Actually, maybe I need to write that. But let's go back to the mudras. Where would you trace the beginnings of this interest?
The funny version of like my direct relationship to it.
Yeah.
Is I was in kind of like, I'm looking for the name of it. In San Diego, there's a Spanish word for like the kind of shop where you would find esoteric things. Like a bodega. It starts with a B as well. But no, more like, you know, like you'll find potions, you'll find candles.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
Right? Botanica.
Right.
Botanica. So I was in like a botanica, you know, like crystals and like then books and like tarot decks and oracle decks and stuff like that. Mm. I was looking at one after another of different decks, and then one by the same author who did this Rumi deck that I quite like. It's a very gentle deck. It's a beautiful deck. The art is fantastic. I've played with the decks in interaction with each other, like thinking through the colors in the paintings, and then the language in both the Rumi poems that they quote and the kind of like response write-up that the author of this book of Oracle cards does. And I've kind of found my way towards mudras from them. But my partner at the time, the very wonderful writer Liz Huerta, an amazing writer who everybody should check out, and she was just like, you've got kind of that direction already, why don't you find something else? And she kind of like pulls this deck off of, like, you know, two kind of like behind the front panel of books that are there, and she's like, oh, that's the one, you know. And of course I had my regular reaction to kind of ancient cultural practices being brought to me by like a European white author. I was like, I don't even know, dog. I don't know if I want to mess with this at all. But I opened it and I kind of fell in love. And when I looked at it, you know, it brought together a few things. It brought together an ancient practice of like interaction between poetry, theater, and martial arts. Mudras do all those things, which are things that I love. Mm-hmm. I have a tendency to be up in my head. And you know, at the time I was teaching, just about to graduate, or it was either just before or just after a graduation from an MFA program at San Diego State University, you know, and working on a book. And so none of those things are body, you know. Mm-hmm. And I was struggling with finding any kind of embodied time. I had, like, before that, you know, I'd stopped smoking I did this Whole 30 kind of cleanse diet that's paleo based, cousin of paleo, and they were harsh. They were like, no smoking. And I've stopped smoking before, but for some reason, without any other vices and with like a challenge to my diet at the same time, I was particularly struggling. So during that time, during that month, I took up juggling as like a thing to do while I would usually have a cigarette. So every time I wanted to have a cigarette, I'd have to like pull out these juggle balls and just start juggling where I was. And that was the closest thing to physical activity I had. So when the mudras came into my life, I was immediately struck by how much they immediately landed me in my body. That to strike a single mudra pose, and then I love the instructions and the ways that they kind of remind you to lengthen your neck, drop your shoulders, and relax. And I find myself, whenever I do them, to really land back in my body, which was something at the time that I was devastatingly in need of. As someone who has always been kind of high active, high frequency of reverberation going on the inside almost at all times, even when I seem to be at my calmest, I was drawn to them. And then immediately I did a whole practice. I washed them in smoke, and I kind of chose one that would be my guiding one. And then I've been practicing really interesting things with them ever since, and lately have gone into some stuff that I actually really I really enjoy, that I think might be innovative, if not some kind of recall of an already existing ancient practice.
So would you say that most of the mudras that you practice are full body gesture or pose, or is it a mix between like some that are more like localized to one part of the body?
They're almost all primarily hand language combined with the way that you carry your body in posture and or how you place your hands. So when I was learning group counseling and group facilitation in another lifetime, we were taught some Qigong, and Qigong, you know, is like cousin slash grandparent of Tai Chi, and is like cousin slash grandparent of Kung Fu as well, Kung Fu. And there was this one movement called Eight Pieces of Silk, or an eight movement sequence. And I was like somewhere in public, and I really felt like I needed to do that sequence, but it's like a full body movement that's, you know, it would have been intrusive on the ferry where I was standing, and on a crowded ferry. And so I kind of just stood there and try to go through the movements inside myself. And so sometimes when I'm on the, so I'll do these mudras on the way to work in the morning. But sometimes doing the mudras is actually like an internal kind of like an attempt to activate the physical movement without actually doing the physical movement.
So this practice of the mudras, do you find, I think you suggested in, we were talking beforehand, you had suggested that in some ways this is starting to inform your latest work, that you're writing toward or around or inspired by things that you're discovering as you practice.
Yeah, like I said, I'm obsessed. And I've always felt like since I first started using them, I was like, the moment I kind of pulled two or three cards, I thought to myself, well, it's like there's seven chakras here. I should try and do sequences of seven. I should try and kind of interact them in a full way, you know? And so less the writing specifically, although there's a poetry that happens when I try to sequence them. But I'm currently obsessed with divining or composing or a combination of the two or just making up, if we don't want to allow me those grandiose claims of sequences that when they're put together are kind of they specifically activate something. The first one came when I was in a major crossroads. I didn't know I needed it. I thought I was coming up with I thought we were just me and David Maduli, who's a really good friend of mine and an amazing poet. Anyway, we got together and we did like a weekend retreat that we just were like, we need this both really badly. Let's do this. So I drove up to Oakland from San Diego. We went to this beautiful place with this giant old redwood there. And in the morning, you know, we're like, how should we do this? Well, let's, you know, some things happened the day before around the notion of the crossroads and in relationship to this Yoruba guardian of the crossroads, the deity Eshu, happened the night before, led us into specific processes that evening. And then in the next morning, we're like, let's wake up and write. And then something told us, let's stop and take care of ourselves. So we like stopped and made like a really nice breakfast. And instead of like rushing ourselves into the work we were kind of there to do, we decided that we were there to kind of like give ourselves space. And in that time, we pulled some mudra. We pulled cards from a different deck, a Ganesh deck that I also have. And the words that came up, acceptance and concentration, were like, okay, that's going to be our work for the day. But then one of us had the bright idea of seeing like, are there mudras for acceptance and concentration? And there weren't. But what we did try to do was combine sets of mudras using the colors and the language in both decks and then like our own kind of like sense as poets to put them together. And so we decided together that acceptance is fearlessness plus oneness, which is like fearlessness is a root chakra mudra and oneness is a crown chakra mudra. So like the lowest and the highest, or like closest to the ground and closest to the sky, or the most inner and the most outer. And then we thought that concentration, we decided and or divined and or like made up and or joked that it would be a combination of determination, which is solar plexus, and inner guidance, which is heart. And so after we did that, we went back and thought, let's get a sequence of seven. And of course, nourishment was part of it. There is a mudra for nourishment. The color orange was all over the cards we pulled. And then I, my version of the last two to fill it out were, I believe, higher knowledge, which is a third eye chakra mudra, and freedom, which like, it looks like, you know, you kind of like clasp your two thumbs and have your palms back to back and open your fingers out. And like, it's like a bird spread, spread wings. Yeah, and that one was kind of like the thing that I pulled from it. And then since then, have been obsessed with coming up with... I've got one that I call Inner Dawn. I've got one called the Divine Collaboration with Your Own Silence. I've got one for discernment, for manifestation. And I made up one most recently just for the idea of phosphorescence, which has been a poetic obsession of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, I guess I need a phosphorescence mudra. And so like caught one of those. That's me rambling for I don't know how long. Sorry about that.
No. But what strikes me as really interesting here is the process you're describing in some ways sounds a lot like how one might guess or puzzle together how different Chinese characters came to be. That they're composed out of individual radicals, that each of which has its own separate meaning, and that composing them or combining them together in certain ways then becomes its own new character. And like with Chinese, like they're not always pictographic. Sometimes the role that they serve is phonetic. Like by adding this radical, it's going to suggest a sound that's similar to that root radical. But in other cases, it may evoke like a, you know, an elemental connection. That this is fire, or this is water related, or this is, you know, this has to do with the earth, or this has to do with you know, something else, metal. And mm-hmm. so like there are different ways in which it might connect together, and some things are, you know, conceptual that they're lending in, but taken together they can, you know, it's interesting. Some things you look at them and you say like there's a whole story that's present here, mm-hmm. about how this might have come to be. In fact, there's a series of children's books I picked up at a used bookstore a few years ago. I guess not a few years ago, it's been some time. That bookstore no longer exists. But it was a series of short books called The Story of, and then it would be like a particular Chinese character. And it was a mixture of calligraphy and sort of a narrative that helped you understand how that character came to be, with the character being an actual character or part of the landscape. Or so it was really kind of interesting how they kind of made it come alive in this particular way. And then it left you with a, you know, a fairly deep understanding of like, you know, even though it's fabricated for the sake of making the story, it right. gave you a sense of like this is a world that's populated by characters which are characters.
I'm in love with this. I want it.
Yeah.
I'll ask you at some point to like send me maybe like more info, because I'd like to find it. I think that there's a real resonance there. I mean, at one point, I think Charlene Chang, who was in Vancouver at the time, but is now back in the Bay Area, originally from New Jersey, she had a poem that was doing that kind of enactment with a specific character.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was, in her case, it was the character for woman, and she made a story, interlaced it with her own life, but also wrote fiction into the poem and kind mm-hmm. of like made it happen. I think that, I mean, it's available, right? It's available. And in some ways, the mudras are like pictogram-ish, you know? And in some ways, it's more like almost like the shape they make your body make as a whole. And in some ways, it's almost like you said, it's more conceptual as to how it works toward embodying the sort of like story that it's telling. And that's what's been the most fun of putting them together, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes there's a poetry in it. I was looking for the in the mudra sequence for Inner Dawn that I'm playing with. I was asking for a sequence for active grieving, because I was going through a moment of like just acknowledging the loss.
Mm-hmm.
And my desire was to run away from it, or just like not even to, I didn't even have a desire to run away with it. I was just really, really aware of the lump that mm-hmm. was inside the body, and like that I was just sitting with and unable to move. And I was like, I need a mudra sequence for active grieving. And I just kind of, you know, I took a break from carpenting. Like, I mean, I was working on this house. Everybody else was inside. I snuck onto the deck, and I just kind of sat there on this like painter's step ladder, or sawhorse, and was like, I need this sequence. And I kind of just sat and did some breathing for a while, And then what came to me was surrender, awakening, transformation. And that's three mudras, surrender being root, awakening being heart, and then transformation being solar plexus. And, you know, it blew my mind at the time. I was like, oh my God, that's exactly what it is. That's what it's supposed to be. And I kind of, you know, I believed the hype, and but it helped me move things. Not immediately, because the lump, you know, grief is a thing. But and of course the loss stays, but it opened my relationship to the grief to make it active, you know? Like going back to martial arts, I was in a sequence of martial arts movement with the grief, as opposed to standing still inside it, like drowning inside it, or other visuals, you know, or like having made a home for it, to use a different.
I'm really fascinated by this, because it to me it sounds, and this may be, you know, I guess one way perhaps to think of it is like, are the mudras and these gestures an act or a means by which you release or expel or let out, somehow channel outward something that is within? Or are they a way in which you summon or invoke or call within something that's without you, that's outside? Or are they both?
I would lean immediately toward both.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, I think that they open up the pathways for the summoning, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like the transformation of like just clunky kind of like lump in the body, lump in the throat, lump in the heart, heavy stone in the stomach, grief, versus like a passage that's open that feels it, but feels it in a form of movement. And that like, so summons an activeness into that grief, and therefore expels some of at least the, you know, the silt that otherwise would never leave, you know, back out. And so it's, I feel like it's this interaction, you know? Yeah, it's the breath piece. It's the calling in and the releasing out. And there's a, you know, and it depends for me, like I'll do the sequences kind of like top to bottom, bottom to top, and then like out of order, like, you know, jumping from one to another. And so I think like if you do it top to bottom, there may be more of a kind of like summoning in. And if you do it like root to crown, there may be more of like a releasing out. And then the back and forth happens when you go back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm treating these things as if everything I'm saying is real. But that's, I think, that's the joyful thing. I'm treating them as if I can say these things out loud without, you know, without compunction. And that's, I think, the thing about it that's the most fun, is to be like, I'm just going to say that as if I mean it. I think I mean it.
Well, I think on some level it's meaningful. Like you wouldn't be invested if it did not bring some sort of peace and some sort of, you know, understanding by doing this. I think what's interesting is, like, you know, on a superficial level, one might look and see the mudras as these set of hand gestures and arm gestures and maybe even full body gestures that, you know, constitute a type of, you know, of symbolic language. But that would be too reductive. It's different. Like initially, I was thinking about this, and I thought, well, in some ways, it reminds me of I took a class years and years ago when I was an undergraduate on the history of rhetoric, and there was a whole discussion around a 17th century author by the name of, I think his name is John Bulwer. I think Bulwer wrote a treatise on the rhetoric of hand positions. And so he studied sort of the ways in which, like, he decided that the natural language of the human being is our hand. Our hand is a more powerful tongue than our tongue, because it crosses over every language. And so it was this really interesting idea. And then he proceeds to try to scientifically and systematically, you'll catalog different hand gestures and what they might emote. What do they suggest, or what do they mean? And then his further theory was that when performing any sort of oratory, one should draw on this body of hand gestures in order to maximize your meaning or to deliver your content in the most effective of ways, that it would supersede, overpower even the language that you use to actually use the language of the hands.
That's interesting. I mean, you know, there's not zero relationship between that and ancient South Asian and like Southeast Asian musical theater, right? Like
that is part of the dance.
Right? And they would say that there's both like more and less to it than what he's kind of trying to claim.
Right. And I would say too, I mean, there is a long tradition, in Near Eastern cultures and religions of hand position, handshakes, gestures, body language as part of religious symbology and ritual. That you do need to exchange certain hand gestures in order to mean certain things or to pass on certain power or to indicate one's authority. All these different things are present in these really old traditions.
Absolutely.
Fully
agreed. Ancient and current, right?
Ancient and current.
Ancient and current.
And some of that persists today. I mean, the very fact that we. We swear people in on a Bible, that or swear allegiance to a flag or salute, all goes back to like the importance of hand gesture and positioning. This is KBOO Portland. If you're just joining us, I'm Neil Aiken, and this is the Lit Fantastic. We're speaking to the poet Hari Aluri about mudras, the body, and how this fascination with expression and movement takes us to martial arts. Let's return to the conversation. I think a lot of it is this gets more tied up into ritual and authority and power, and less so about what you're talking about with mudras, which is really about opening these channels and connecting us with this larger universe. And I think that's perhaps where the break is, where the separation is, that superficially there's a resemblance, and yet at the same time, there's a real diametric difference between how it's evolved in its use today versus what it meant to other people. Yeah. I would say perhaps the one place where there's some sort of still remains some crossover is sign language and the language for the deaf. It goes beyond simply a spelling out of things into an actual performative, telling, a relaying and emoting and an evoking of a world or a sentence or an idea, that goes beyond simply, the alphabet.
No, fully, full agreement. And then, of course, and this is another from another similar conversation with a friend of mine, I would go so far as to include gang signs in that. Like, there's a relationship, for example, and gang signs in relationship to, perhaps kung fu movies, but also perhaps before that, and just like the welcomingness, the secret handshake. The way that belonging becomes translated through the body in a way that allows for an interior and an exterior to be communicated, and then of course back to martial arts and those ancient forms of dance, and also and to double that, I'm thinking specifically of like African American culture, thinking of the ways in which breakdancing in some ways seems to have divined capoeira with or without direct access to it. I think it was there, but I also think that a certain amount of it was this kind of ends up being this interaction backward and forward, where some folks were like carrying that capoeira art forward, and some folks were kind of finding their way into it from a different place, and then they meet. I like to geek out about those those ways in which the ancient and the contemporary kind of find each other. Mm-hmm. You know, and I always feel like there's a, like, one of the things I'm almost like adamant in my esoteric enunciation or utterance is like these things are almost, if not actually, impossible to completely, you know, to completely wipe out, because the histories of violence we've been in, including the one we're in right now with the, you know, with the separation of parents and children,
mm-hmm.
these histories have, you know, have been attempts at eradication of so much connection, and yet we continue to make them. So that's me kind of like, but it's the reason I'm saying it partially is almost at a spiritual kind of like ancestral connection, almost, but also a community and like activated notion that like folks find a way to retain and transform these forms of knowledge, communication, spirituality, discipline, joy, dance, love, mm-hmm. song, you know, gesture.
Right. And I think what you're getting at too is perhaps like one of the reasons why, I mean, there are many reasons why it's absolutely abhorrent what's happening, you know, at the mm-hmm. border and the separation of families. But I think part of it is just a symbology of the breaking of that grasp, of that the hand holding is now separated. You know, how profoundly, you know, devastating that is to strike hands apart. And how old and persistent that image is of the clasp hand as sort of a sign of unity, of fellowship and of peace. Mm-hmm. And so, so it is deeply disturbing when we see that corrupted and or we see it broken and separated. I wanted to shift slightly.
Let me jump in quickly before your shift and just note that the mudra for inner truth is greatly resembling of the clasping of one's own hands.
Oh, interesting.
I just wanted to throw that in based on what you said, but let me follow your shift after that.
Yeah, so I was thinking, you know, in terms of you know, this talk about violence also brings us back to something you talked about earlier, which is sort of the strange paradox of martial arts, that it can, you know, the training can bring one tremendous inner peace and control and sensitivity to one's body and relation to the universe. Well, at the same time, the origin and ultimately the underlying purpose, or at least its foundational mm-hmm. purpose, was still nonetheless to exert power and control over another's body. And so I was wondering, what are your thoughts as someone who is both invested and interested in it, and also a practitioner of it?
You know what? My first response is actually to jump to a different obsession, namely fantasy, and to think about, you know, the book, The Name of the Wind, Patrick Rothfuss, I think we're talking about.
Yeah, I know.
Right?
Yes.
And I mean, that, you know, the concept of, I think he pronounces it Alar. Uh-huh. I pronounce it Alar because it rolls off my tongue more naturally. However, you know,
you can
Alar
claim it's the Canadian accent.
Yeah, exactly. Alar, or maybe it's a migrant accent. Alar is a migrant accent. Multiple migration accents in my ancestry, in my body, but you know, the holding of two otherwise impossible truths at the same time.
Yeah,
and like I have been obsessed. Like I love that. You know, paradox is one thing, but the full carrying of impossible to recognize truths, I'm in love with.
I actually love the Chinese term for this type of paradox. Is Maodun. Maodun. Mao is the spear that will pierce anything, and Dun is the shield that will block anything. And so just what happens when they meet?
Yo. And so that, you know, that phrase, you know. Yeah. And it's
hard. It's a martial image is like those things coming together. But you know, yeah. So I think it is. It is what I guess. What am I saying? What draws you to this? What is the fascination with martial arts?
You know, the easy cop-out answer for me is that, and I have multiple, but the easy cop-out answer is like, you know, when you've practiced something, there's a way in which your relationship to it is transformed.
Yeah.
You know, there's a way in which your seeing is transformed. The same way that, you know, I'll never know the intricacies of a few North American sports. Like, it took me 20 years to actually see hockey beautiful. You know, I could observe it, I could, like, you know, appreciate the athleticism and things like that, but for me to actually see who was doing what, you know, more than like, oh, they scored or they seem to still have the puck, to be like, oh, they did this sequence of passes under this understanding of the rank in relationship to the movements of the other players, you know. So it took me 20 years to see that. And, you know, the same thing goes for forms of dance, theater. You know, one might argue that, like, you know, and I mean, you know, one's appreciation for poetry and the question of, like, how did they do that always comes up when you're in love with a thing and you practice a thing. And so on the one side, it's that. Was it having kind of, like, grown up a little bit in it? You know, I did Shotokan karate in, like, grade school, and then I practiced these mixed martial arts themselves and you know, at different points intermittent in my life. It's been some time since I can, it's been long enough that I can't quite claim myself to be a practicing martial artist. Although I will practice every so often by myself. And of course, cop out and say, like, oh yeah, and Bruce says that the, you know, the highest form of training is self-training. So occasionally the highest form. That doesn't mean I'm any good at it. It just means I'm, you know, hanging out.
I was waiting for you to say the highest form of training is non-training.
Yes.
To eliminate within you, a very Zen thing to do would be to eliminate even the desire to train, because that is that holds you to the world,
right?
And, like, so and it holds you to your body, and you should let go of that too.
You know, yeah, that's actually a much better cop-out, I think. I quote you. I ask you for permission to coach you in future conversations about martial arts.
My interaction with martial arts is comical at best, and borrowed for the most part. When I was in grade school, as a mixed race Chinese Scottish kid, I managed to avoid any fights with other school kids by pretending that I knew martial arts and posing in dramatic forms and then frightening people out.
It worked back then.
It worked. Back then it worked.
Because the actual assumption was that if you, like, that somehow it had been transmitted to you.
Somehow I had it in my genetic makeup.
In your genetic makeup. And while you were sitting in class, there was another interdimensional part of Neil that was actually practicing martial arts outside class.
Outside of class, exactly.
Honing his skills, becoming an impossibly astute warrior, while you were also sitting in class next to your fellow students.
Later,
yeah, 1,000-year psychic battles.
Yeah, later when I was pursuing my undergraduate, I had a roommate who was Iranian, who had fled. Long story. He had become a political refugee at the age of 10, I think, for writing an essay against the government. It was a rather foolish thing to do. Ended up in Pakistan, and then ended up in Sweden, and then eventually came to the States for school. But he was trained in many different martial arts. He was trained in Iranian martial arts. He was also trained in Wing Chun, and he was trained in Thai kickboxing and at least two other martial arts. I remember the first time I sat down with him and introduced him to Jet Li and Fist of Legend.
Yeah.
And it was eye-opening for him and eye-opening for me. For him, he had never seen Jet Li perform, and Fist of Legend is actually one of the movies where he's not flying around.
Right.
And all the shots are long shots of him actually doing these things. And so it was really, you know, he saw the martial arts in a completely different way than I did when I was watching it. And so he explained to me, he'd stop and rewind and show me what was happening about why this was so outstanding or unusual or unbelievable what he had achieved in this one, you know, moment in this one particular fight scene. And it was eye-opening because it was like you were saying, it's like up until that moment, I had no clue. You know, I didn't know what to look for, so I didn't understand, other than sort of like, oh, that was a cool fight scene. I didn't understand what was going on. And so it opened my mind to like, oh, there's a lot more that's going on here. There's a lot of things that are, you know, outstanding simply from the physicality of it. It's just really unexpected that the body can pull this off. but it's also like unusual, right? In terms of like the I just sort of like the gracefulness of what's being done too. How all these different moves are seamlessly woven together and just, you know, instantaneously, you know, in a shot. And so I thought about that and I thought, you know, there it is something of a dance in this moment. And you're right, you know, it does bring us back too to think about poetry and how seamless it can be. You know, like it takes us a long time to really understand what's happening in the poetry we admire most, that we're moved by the most. And it seems like it is silk and we don't see all the threads that go into it. You know, it's like, oh, there's so much more to it.
You got me searching a phrase out. What is the word for choreography? So the calligraphy of choreography is what you had me think.
Yes, as I followed
your silk metaphor, I'm like, oh my God.
Well, there's a whole improvisational skill that goes on both on the battlefield and on the dance floor, and arguably on the blank page for the calligrapher or for the poet.
Absolutely.
And so like to be able to channel that is something magical and beautiful. And it's all that illusion of ease, right? You see someone do it in a single gesture, not realizing it's composed of 100 micro gestures, each of which is, if we go back to the mudras, opening and channeling and redirecting things to enable this power to come into play.
I'm sitting with that. I'm loving that. I'm trying to think of I'm making the to try and remember what you said. I'm going to go so far as to make the mudra for receiving together. All right, I'm trying to remember this phrase. We're talking about the single fluid motion made up of so many interacting motions at the same time. Manifestation.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
When you talked about, you know, the how much we, but then again, we also. Like, you know, I used to make this sequence of martial arts moves that was essentially a combination of Bollywood plus Kung Fu that, you know, that the people in my neighborhood, unluckily for me, knew enough to know was like complete. They were like, oh yeah, Hari style Cobra, Bollywood Cobra is not a move, honey, I'm sorry. They're like, we have also watched both Bollywood and Kung Fu and this will not help you at all.
I will admit to occasionally borrowing Tai Chi moves and weaving them onto the dance floor and seeing if anyone notices.
Oh, I definitely take, I used to sneak Kali, Filipino Kali handboxing, like flow, which, you know, there's a relationship between Qigong and Kali in the sense of the soft hands and the like, and the kind of like hand trap and movement that happens very both fast and fluidly. And, you know, one of the tests, again, you know, you might think that the trick is to be more rigid or more strong or whatever, but like you actually, like, you learn so much about where a person is at based on their flow hands. If their flow hands are off, that means their breathing is off. That means they might be in a difficult emotional state. That means they might be dealing with something else outside of here, or they just may be like, you know, just not in that flow space themselves. And so when you go back to like the beginning of the conversation, those three types of tests that, you know, that you did, apart from being able to fight, and I mean, my most, you know, when I was a kid, my most vivid memories of being actually knocked out and then being handed my belt afterwards, which was amazing. By a fellow student, I defended, and then Uche, she got a beautiful like roundhouse kick to the side of my head, and I think I went down. It was beautiful. Must have been beautiful to behold from everywhere else but my view. But you know, like part of the test is like how easeful is your flow?
Yeah.
Like how can you resist without resisting? How can you push back without seeming to like need force? But you're using force, but it's all within that magic.
I would love to stay and keep talking about this, but unfortunately our time is drawing to an end. Before
my flow hand is broken by my emotional devastation at the end of the conversation.
So before we wrap up, would it be possible for you to read one or two poems for us?
Yeah. So I'm working on these poems. Ekalavya is you know, it kind of like brings it all together.
Mm-hmm.
He's this he's a figure from the Mahabharata. He's a minor figure, right? He was he's tribal and therefore not like prior to the caste system, but judged from within the caste system. And I'd go longer, but like what I want to say, the brief thing is, he decides to become an archer, gets rejected by the guru, whose job it is to teach the princes how to be the greatest fighters in the land. And he goes and he builds a statue of the guru, prays to it, and proceeds to make himself better than all the rest of them. But I'll read one or two poems from that sequence that I that is like one of my other obsessions. I actually, you know, it's a book that I continue to write other books while I try to get to the point where I can finally actually write this book. So here's a recent kind of still in draft mode, but it's called Touch. The knife blade is the shape of seeking. This blade, the dark-limbed boy sharpened the features of his guru with. This thumb he licked to bulbous them and smooth. If I were the guru, Ekalavya formed with river clay, I would kiss my own statue, find inside my lips Ekalavya's lips. Twined, an image, thumb blood dropped to knife in a clearing, flowers smeared from day after day after month after years of archery practice, thousands of steps back and forth between bent bow and tree. Such an intimacy, this act of shaping clay. The folds in the robes and ligaments, the palms outfacing, the eyes of his guru, his own eyes with which to aim. Overture. Even a former alpha dog wants God for a charioteer. But two attendants at my chain, I would gnaw like the mange, the self-fulfilling promise of blood. I rowdied the air so it would gnaw dear into the bowlines of my masters. 105 princes playing hunt, I fed them braggadocio. They threw me the choicest bones to gnaw. When I was done, the other dogs could fight over what marrow. Eat my leftovers, my tail would say, that type of wag, no more. That day I gnawed the jungle clearing air, burst in with my growl. Then a quiet of six arrows chiding. My mandible stuck open, the flavor of iron and whittled rose jockeying at my tongue, gnawing my voice a stopped frontier, my maw a vase, sprouting plumage, every muscle from tail to tooth drunk on their new fear of rowdying the air around your hunter's meditation, the way you gnawed at perfection, turning back to your tree, not bullseye, as if I was a miss, not worth drawing blood, a scar, not even. What you did was shabda bhedi, apex predation. I fled from my own gnaw. Now my scent can't free itself from the past it clings to. Yours remains an odor I cannot follow, a steady incompletion, my yelp still in the throat. It buries and redigs up the gnaw you gave me, acting like it doesn't hunger your bow. The dust around you, unsettled at its own settling, nose to the ground and still, still as when I used to crouch before the leap. A bone gnawing like the jungle did me then, leaf laugh, trunk lurk, tiger smirk, monkey heckle, parrot and deer bark at my back, as if the underbrush's gnaw lashed whispers at my tail tuck run. My burst upon the caravan started my prince out his chariot, because you did what he could not imagine. My arrowed mouth gnawed what his birthright promised, his royal skill to get you, low-born fool, rewarded for your trespass. You sever your thumb from the hunt and don't so much as whimper. Gnaw, Ekalavya, bloody on this. Not I, but you are the kick dog of this story. Sport, how thrown you will never sit like a choke chain at your throat. Your thumb, a blossom in my teeth. Your beauty, mine to gnaw.
So this is an ongoing book project that is not out yet.
Not out yet. This is like, you know, I was thinking about, but because of our conversations, the martial arts and the mudras and all this, it kind of leans much more in this direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I mean, this is like, you know, this is part of what I know I want to follow the Flint City with.
Mm-hmm.
And it has some seedlings planted and lying around in sections of the Flint City. I've never read either of those. Definitely the last one I've never read before. So I'm really grateful for the conversation that led to that, you know?
Well, we're pleased to have you on and thrilled that you were able to be a part of the show. Thank you so much for joining us, Hari.
Gratefulness mudra is receiving plus unconditional love. That's my thing I try to do every day. So mad gratefulness to you, and I'm just super glad to have connected with you on the Lit Fantastic.
That was the poet Hari Aluri. To find out more about Hari and his latest book, The Flayed City, which is just out from Kaya Press, visit the website for Kaya Press at www.kaya.com. To listen to previous episodes of The Lit Fantastic, visit www.thelitfantastic.com or find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, or KBOO.FM in the archive. Thank you again for listening to another episode of The Lit Fantastic. And until next time, I'm your host, Neil Aiken.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor an afternoon with Wahyu and Friends Saturday, July 14th from 2 to 5 p.m. in Lake Oswego. Gamelan Wahyu are hosting a fundraising event to help members study abroad in Bali during the summer of 2019. Performers include Agents of Echo, Dolphin Midwives, and Gamelan Wahyu. Refreshments will be provided. Again, that's an afternoon with Wahyu and Friends, Saturday, July 14th from 2 to 5 p.m. at 3548 Lakeview Boulevard in Lake Oswego. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
First off, they'll say what it is, a festival.
Hey, folks, I want to tell you about the first annual Best of the Northwest Vernonia Springs Music Festival. It's going to take place on July 7th, 2018. KBOO is our co-sponsor, and our headliners are Lloyd Jones and Baby Gramps.
Sometimes known as Sourdough Dolly.
Would you give him a pledge of that good old Mountain Dew?
www.vernoniasprings.com/VSMF. To learn more, go to kboo.fm.
And people think, he's so old, he squeaks. And I will prove that.
Look for the Vernonia Springs Music Festival.
And I'd like to convert it into a bedlam of jive. Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Good evening. This is KBOO in Portland. It's 11 o'clock. Time for Fear and Loathing in L.A. Or rather, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas by Hunter S. Thompson.
He who makes a beast of himself gets rid of the pain of being a man.
We were somewhere around Barstow on the edge of the desert when the drugs began to take hold. I remember saying something like,
I feel a bit lightheaded. Maybe you should drive.
And suddenly, there was a terrible roar all around us, and the sky was full of what looked like huge bats,
all swooping and screeching and diving around the car,
which was going about 100 miles an hour,
with the top down to Las Vegas.
Holy Jesus! What are these goddamn animals?
My attorney had taken off his shirt and was pouring beer on his chest to facilitate the tanning process.
What the hell are you yelling about? Never mind, it's your turn to drive. No point in mentioning those bats. The poor bastard will see them soon enough.
Very soon we would both be completely twisted.